From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Conservative courts and judicial activism. Hello again, I'm Armin Almy, and this is To the Point. Our first topic on this program was the national crisis over Bush versus Gore when the U.S. Supreme Court decided the 2000 presidential election. Florida's state courts were summarily overridden by Supreme Court justices who'd promised to uphold states' rights. One dissenter called the majority crudely partisan. On this last week, before To the Point turns to podcasting only, we'll hear what's happening now. From the Supreme Court on down, President Trump has promised to choose judges from lists of conservative activists. On today's Talking Point later, a leadership purge in Saudi Arabia. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Mormon. I'll be back with To the Point. The U.S. Supreme Court decided the presidential election in the year 2000. The majority overruled the courts of Florida despite their promises to uphold states' rights. That was the first big story for this program. Today, we'll look at what's happened since to the federal courts. Today's Talking Point, charged with corruption, 11 princes, 4 ministers, and tens of former officials have been arrested in Saudi Arabia. The royals are being held at Riyadh's Ritz-Carlton Hotel, including one billionaire with many American interests. Is it a sign of strength or weakness by Crown Prince bin Salman, the future king of the country? We'll look at that. First, this news update. Yesterday's massacre at a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, was not fueled by racial or religious issues. That's according to law enforcement. They attribute 26 deaths and 20 injuries to what's called an ongoing domestic situation, apparently with the gunman's mother-in-law. He was Devin Patrick Kelly, who was court-martialed by the Air Force for assaulting his wife and child. Here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott.
All the facts that we seem to know, he was not supposed to have access to a gun. So how did this happen?
Despite his background, Kelly was armed with an assault-style rifle and a couple of pistols. He apparently killed himself. Juliet Kayyem is former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security. She runs a security consulting firm, appears on CNN, and she hosts the podcast Security Mom. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much, Warren.
So you've called these incidents, such as this, such as the one in Las Vegas, so very recently, national security issues.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, national security is about our homeland security. It is about how do you minimize the risk to our populations, to our communities. And we tend to think of it solely as terrorism, right? Because we have these legal definitions of terrorism. Terrorism, it's sort of, you know, after 9/11 is how we thought about homeland security. But really what homeland security is risks and vulnerabilities do our communities have, and how do we minimize those risks, knowing that we're never going to get it to zero? So any rational person looking out in the world would say, I'm not so worried about ISIS. ISIS scares me, but in terms of the numbers, they're not killing our children in churches. It is actually, you know, mental issues, mental health issues, combined with a country that has a lot of people with mental health issues armed. And so that's why I think if we could just get our head around, thinking about our own vulnerabilities as a homeland as being tied to guns and the accessibility of guns, we then might try to come to some solutions.
Here's President Trump in Tokyo today analyzing the situation in a somewhat different way.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries, but this isn't a guns situation.
Juliet Kayyem, back to you. How do you take that comment?
It's a political argument, and it purposefully bifurcates motivation from means. So every country has a problem with people with mental health disorders. Not every country has the mass murders, right, the mass casualty events that we have because they either have stricter gun laws or they are not a culture, you know, they don't have communities that have gun cultures. So by bifurcating, President Trump puts everything in the motivation camp. But if you took a step back and you think, wait a second, almost every other harm that we face as a community, whether it's opiates, whether it's terrorism, whether it's climate change, or if it's mass shootings, we never just look at the motivation. Think about opiates, for example. Everyone knows that you can't just look at addiction. You have to look at the supply chain and law enforcement and public health and the medical community and the health community. You have to look at it from multiple viewpoints. But by bifurcating it, President Trump has made a strategic political move that makes us just think about this as, isn't it a shame Kelly didn't get along with his mother-in-law? Oh, that's the takeaway here. No, the takeaway is Kelly had problems with his family and mental problems, and either through fraud, illegality, or major mistake, in other words, they didn't know that he shouldn't be getting a gun, he had access to lots of guns. All of those explanations are fixable if we would just look at the policies behind what's going on, whether it was fraud, mistake, or illegality.
Even Governor Abbott, whom we just heard from, former Attorney General of Texas and a real hardliner, said he wasn't supposed to have those guns. So that suggests that there was some problem with the Texas gun laws. Before we go into that, though, what about the fact that there was a neighbor, apparently a guy across the street, who heard the shooting, came out with his own gun and pursued the suspect, who then ran away? Is that a case of a good guy versus a bad guy, both with guns?
Yeah, I mean, look, that is obviously a case in which someone with a gun was helpful in stopping an attack like this. In most instances, in the majority of instances, as we saw, for example, in the Walmart case, which we don't even talk about, which was just a week ago in which two or three people died, so many people pulled out guns, the cops did not know who the culprits were. So, yes, there's always going to be incidents where, you know, maybe a good guy with a gun could help. Okay. That certainly wasn't true in Las Vegas. But the truth is better the bad guy not have a gun, right? I mean, that's the better solution in terms of our risk assessment.
All right. Juliette Kayyem, again, former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security. Always good to talk with you, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, conservative courts and judicial activism on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. This is the last week before To the Point turns to podcasting only. The radio program started in the year 2000 when the nation was paralyzed by an undecided election and all eyes were turned to the state of Florida.
A big call to make. CNN announces that we call Florida in the Al Gore column. This is a state.
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column. George Bush, governor of Texas, will become the 43rd president of the United States.
The vice president has recalled the governor and retracted his concession.
This race is simply too close to call.
We're only back with PRI's To the Point. For the first time ever, the U.S. Supreme Court has released a full audio tape recording of a history-making proceeding. Today's arguments over this year's presidential election in Florida.
On World News Tonight, the presidential election is over. George Bush prevails by one vote in the Supreme Court. Al Gore prepares to concede. The high court's decision causes furious debate.
So, Supreme Court justices, confirmed in part because of their commitment to states' rights, stopped the recount ordered by the Florida Supreme Court and declared George W. Bush the winner. On To the Point on December 1st, 2000, constitutional scholar Dennis Hutchinson made this prediction.
The worst thing they could do, absolutely the worst thing they could do, is to divide 5-4 either way.
Why?
Because it will appear to be a partisan decision on either side. There will be rancorous language in the opinions on both sides. and the American public will think that there's no stability, that the idea of the rule of law is subject to partisanship and rhetoric at any point.
And, of course, the ultimate decision was 5-4. Jeffrey Toobin is staff writer for The New Yorker. He's senior legal analyst for CNN as well, and it's always good to have you on our show.
Hi, Warren.
In 2010, you wrote that, in fact, the justices violated their conservative principles when they, the five justices, when they made that decision. You still feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. Although, you know, time has passed and only three justices in the majority are still on the court. Justice O'Connor and Chief Justice Rehnquist have left the court. But I do. I think it was a dark moment in the history of the court, and it's a good example of Justice Robert Jackson's famous admonition about the Supreme Court: we are not final because we are infallible. We are infallible because we are final.
Why do you say that this was a bad thing? Why was it a dark moment?
Because it's one thing to reach a principled decision that does not align with what you want the outcome to be in any given case. But I think what you saw with the five justices in the majority was that they were justices who, as you pointed out, generally believed in states' rights, who generally believed that there should be a narrow conception of the Equal Protection Clause. In this one case, found that the 14th Amendment rights to equal protection guaranteed to George W. Bush were denied by the Florida court interpreting Florida law about a Florida state election. And I thought it reeked of results-oriented jurisprudence and not a principled approach to decision-making.
And one of the dissenters in that case, as you pointed out in your article, called this crudely partisan.
That's right. And people outside the court called it a lot worse. I mean, you had, again, two of the four justices in the minority are now gone. Justice Souter and Justice Stevens have retired. But I think the criticism of the majority opinion in Bush v. Gore was disappointingly partisan. I don't think there was any other explanation for the result.
After he resigned, David Souter, who was a relatively moderate justice, said he wanted to resign after this decision, but he didn't until somewhat later.
True enough, he was pretty discouraged, and but I think it's no coincidence that he waited until a Democrat became president in 2009. And Justice Souter resigned promptly thereafter. I think he became very alienated from the modern Republican Party, though he himself had been a Republican in New Hampshire politics before he became a judge.
Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker, senior legal analyst for CNN. Come join us on our podcast. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
Robert Barnes covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. Hi, Robert. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Warren.
What's happened since then, and how partisan has the court been? We heard that Justice Souter waited to resign until a Democrat could appoint his successor. What are we seeing since that time, and bring us up to the present?
Well, I mean, one thing that we've seen that's changed about the court is until recently, the court always had a conservative Democrat or a liberal Republican, as Jeffrey was just talking about, for instance, with Justice Souter. What we have now is that the five conservatives, consistent conservatives on the court, were all appointed by Republican presidents. The four consistent liberals on the court were all appointed by a Democratic president. And thus, you know, it is easy to see there those 5-4 conservative liberal decisions through a sort of partisan lens.
Certainly the Senate was partisan when it came to replacing Justice Scalia. They wouldn't even vote or hold a hearing on President Obama's nominee, even though he had almost a year to serve in office.
That's right. That was a real change. I mean, some would argue that they've never really faced a circumstance quite like that one. But it was clear. The Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, said that this seat will not be filled by President Obama, no matter who his nominee is. We are going to wait until after the election and let the new president fill it.
He was suggesting, apparently, that the voters ought to pick the next justice, but that's really not what the framers of the Constitution had in mind, is it?
No, it's not. It is up to the president to make a nomination. It's up to the Senate to either confirm or turn down that person. In this case, President Obama nominated a judge from the D.C. Circuit, and he didn't even get a hearing.
That point, we can understand why the framers created lifetime jobs for the justices, so they wouldn't be subject to the politics of the moment. It appears that their effort is somewhat to being overcome.
Well, I think that the courts have become extremely important, perhaps even more important as Congress has become more gridlocked. So many important decisions are being decided by the courts that their importance have really been ramped up in recent times. And that has made these confirmation battles even more partisan than they were in the past. And they were pretty partisan then, too.
They've got gerrymandering coming up and also an issue of union dues. That's come back before them more than once. Just briefly, if you will, explain what's at stake in those cases.
Well, in the gerrymandering case, it's an extremely important case because the Supreme Court has never found that partisan gerrymandering, that is, drawing districts to help one party over another, they've never found that unconstitutional the way they have with, say, racial gerrymandering, which would be to hurt minority groups by the way the districts are drawn. If the court decides that partisan gerrymandering can be so severe that a state's plan can be thrown out as unconstitutional, that would really mark a huge change in the way these districts are drawn.
Let me turn to Zoe Tillman, reporter covering the courts and justice for BuzzFeed. Good to have you on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but other federal courts, the appellate and district courts. There are a lot of them. How important are they, and what's happening with regard to appointments to those courts?
They're tremendously important. You know, the vast majority of cases that come up through the courts don't make it to the Supreme Court. So the federal appeals courts are often the last word on any number of legal issues, and district courts are on the front lines in terms of immediate court action. We've seen district judges across the country blocking the Trump administration's travel ban. So the lower courts are incredibly important. This administration came in with more than 100 lower court seats already open for President Trump to fill. That was, you know, double what Obama inherited when he took office. It was far more than what President George W. Bush inherited when he took office. So coming in off the bat, President Trump has already had an opportunity to really reshape the federal judiciary right away in a way that his immediate predecessors did not.
Robert Barnes, does it appear that those openings were sort of held for a Republican to be elected?
Well, absolutely they were. The Republicans were in control of the Senate. They refused to act on a number of Obama nominees, and the seats were left open. Now, that's not to say only Republicans do this. Democrats did it, too. When they controlled the Senate and the White House was under control of a different party. But the reason that there are so many openings is because Republicans refused to act on a lot of Obama nominees.
Zoe Tillman, back to you. So there appears to be a sort of pipeline set up by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Organization of Conservative Judges. And the president appears to be choosing from lists provided by those organizations.
You know, we know that a lot of nominees are members of the Federalist Society, which is not unusual. It's a membership group for conservative lawyers. And we know that the head of the Federalist Society, Leonard Leo, was an advisor to Trump during the campaign last year on the Supreme Court vacancy. The administration has made no secret of the fact that they're looking for not only conservative nominees, but young nominees. They recognize that these are lifetime appointments. And, you know, getting judges confirmed now has the potential to have far-reaching impacts that go beyond this administration by, you know, many decades in some cases, depending on how young they actually are when they get confirmed. So this has been a real priority for the administration. It's something that they were thinking about last year during the campaign, during the transition, and they've moved very quickly to get nominees over to the Senate in the hopes that Senate Republicans would act as quickly as they could. And what we've seen is that's what's happening, that Republicans are moving, you know, quickly to get nominees through committee onto the Senate floor. There have already been fights over whether Republicans can change certain rules that would speed up the process even more. But this has been a real priority for the Trump administration and for Senate Republicans as well.
Dahlia Lithwick is with us, a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. Welcome to you. Always good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the consequence of this effort on the part of the Republicans?
I think it's exactly what Zoe's saying, which is that this has been a laser focus to put younger, more conservative jurists on the bench. We've seen the kinds of people that have been put up in recent months are the sorts of people who never, ever, ever would have even had a hearing a year ago. You know, people who are bloggers, who one now judge who called Justice Kennedy a prostitute, you know, extraordinary language coming from people who are now on the bench. And I think that the consequence will be that what we're seeing right now, which is the judicial branch acting as this pretty consistent bulwark against some of the worst excesses that we've seen in the Trump's sort of unlawful attacks on the rule of law, and we've seen in the sanctuary cities context, in the travel ban context, in one context after another, we've seen judges a little bit standing firm against that. And I think as the judiciary changes, I mean, 150 seats filled not by center-right John Roberts types, but by pretty radical, very young jurists who I think tend to put ends over means. I think that we may be eroding the ways in which the judicial branch stands as a meaningful check against the other two branches.
Robert Barnes, back to you with the Washington Post. Here's a potential judge who called Justice Kennedy a prostitute. Could the Democrats stop him with a filibuster?
No. And perhaps the Democrats can blame themselves for that because sort of tired with the delay in affirming some of President Obama's nominees, Democrats got rid of the filibuster for judicial nominees for those courts, the lower courts. And so now some of the judges that would have in the past needed to get 60 votes to get through don't need that anymore.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, the Democrats didn't see this coming, or they thought they were going to win the presidential election?
I think that they felt like this was a tit-for-tat proposition. And as Bob says, folks were getting blocked. Home state senators were blue-slipping, using a procedural mechanism to block having hearings for Obama judges. I think that there was a sense that we'd better get rid of the filibuster for lower court judges because we got to move this process along. In fairness, I think they did come to an agreement, the leadership of the Judiciary Committee, that we're not going to allow this for the Supreme Court. We're going to do away with the filibuster, but it would be tantamount to an all-out declaration of war if we started filibustering at the Supreme Court, and then Gorsuch happened.
Okay. We're going to take Gorsuch, of course, the man that President Trump appointed and who was approved to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk further about him and about the courts as well after we take a brief break on our talking point later, a leadership purge in Saudi Arabia. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, we're not only back with To the Point, talking today about the U.S. Supreme Court and what's happened to it since this program began in the year 2000, when we talked so much about Bush versus Gore, a decision, of course, that was extraordinarily important because it chose the President of the United States by overcoming state laws, those in the state of Florida. At least they overcame them for the moment. We don't really know how that election would have come turned out if, in fact, a recount had occurred. In any case, President Trump now is drawing nominees for a very large number of appellate and lower courts, district courts, from a certain list. And here's what he said about it at a cabinet meeting last week.
We will have a big percentage of the court will be changed by this administration over a very short period of time. I don't believe, other than perhaps when they started the whole process, I don't believe anybody's come close. So we'll have 145, and that number will be increasing with time, 145 district court judges, and we'll have 17 court of appeals judges. And I must tell you, the Wall Street Journal gave us great reviews on that.
Ilya Shapiro is senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, libertarian organization. Ilya Shapiro, good to have you back on our show.
Good to be back. Happy to be part of your last week greatest hits commentary, as it were.
Well, thank you. And hopefully you will be part of our podcast as we go forward, as well as our other guests, I'm hoping, as well. What about what we just heard the president say, that no other president comes close to having nominated so many judges? And what about the judges that he is nominating, particularly one who called Justice Kennedy a prostitute? Are these the people that you and other libertarians and perhaps conservatives as well want to see?
There's so much to unpack in the show so far. Trump exaggerated on this point than he has on a lot of things that he said during his presidency. He's not too far off the mark. He had a lot of vacancies. He's made a record number of nominations, certainly ahead of anybody in modern times. And I think with the last slew of confirmations last week, he's, I think, ahead of where anybody was, at least going back, I think, four decades. I haven't looked past that. So, we're not like heads and shoulders above any of that, but certainly more successful in that regard. Part of that is certainly getting rid of the filibuster. I'm actually happy that there is no more filibuster at any level. Harry Reid, for the very first time ever in American history, started using partisan filibuster of judicial nominees in 2003. So I'm glad that that's to be done with. And so the Senate majority is the whole ballgame. And I think I agreed with the Republicans' Senate strategy of not having a vote, not taking up any nominee. This wasn't about Garland. It was about saving it, keeping the seat open for the election. You know, the last time that there was a vacancy that arose during the presidential election year that was filled by a party opposite to that of the president was 1888. These things just don't happen a lot, and especially in our polarized time. I understood and agreed with where the Republicans were coming from, and they took a political gamble, and the voters rewarded them.
Well, what about what's happening now? And are you and our conservatives in general looking for people like Chief Justice John Roberts or Anthony Kennedy, who are thought of as conservative but moderate conservatives?
I'm looking. I can only speak for myself. You know, there's lots of different views from different conservatives, libertarians, originalists, textualists, whomever. And I certainly want someone in the mold of Justice Gorsuch or Alex Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit or Janice Rogers Brown on the D.C. Circuit. People who are willing to hold the government's feet to the fire and rule against it when it's going beyond its bounds or violating somebody's rights. And this is something that the Federalist Society and a lot of conservatives have learned over the years. At first, they learned that they want to avoid the situation of a Souter or a Stevens or a Kennedy, perhaps someone who's moderate to begin with or moves left in office. They learned that lesson. But then with Chief Justice Roberts, they learned that there's a difference between originalism and textualism versus being judicially restrained. And nobody can accuse Roberts of having moved left. It's just that in big cases, especially what we've seen in Obamacare, he would rather defer to the status quo. And that's certainly not my view. I'm not a fan of restraint or activism. I want judges simply to judge, to apply their constitutional theories, and let the chips fall where they may.
Roberts, of course, upheld the Affordable Care Act a couple of times. He was the deciding vote in those cases. Is that something that you object to?
Absolutely. I mean, I filed briefs. I was active in the public conversation. Been on TV and radio programs with Dahlia and Jeff, your other guests, Certainly, I think the government went past its bounds there, and that's why a lot of the folks that are now being that have gone through the Federalist Society membership and have gone through law school when it wasn't a debate about restraint versus activism, but more about more nuanced issues of how to properly apply originalism and textualism, and that aren't ends motivated, but they are applying the constitutional theories as best they can.
So often conservatives attack liberal justices as being activist. It seems to me you want conservatives who are active.
Active, not activist, or engaged, sometimes the word is used. Look, I don't want to have a fight or an argument with people about whether a certain judge is being too activist or too restrained. That's judicial mode. I'd rather debate what the meaning of the First Amendment is, what the meaning of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce is, not whether judge should defer more or less to the government. Look, the third branch, the Article III, is supposed to check the other branches. And so if I think a judge got a particular clause of the Constitution or interpretation of a statute wrong, let's debate that rather than whether the judge was too active or restrained or what have you. The word activism really doesn't mean anything anymore. It's used by both left and right simply to indicate that they don't like the judge or opinion.
Dahlia Lithwick, back to you, senior editor, legal correspondent at Slate.com. If, in fact, active or activism doesn't mean anything anymore, does that mean that the court has become more political?
No, I think that Ilya's right. I think it has always been code for I don't like this outcome. I think that the court is in a really complicated place, Warren, because post-Bush v. Gore, which is where we started this conversation, there was a sense that the court had intruded far too deeply into the political life of the nation. As recently as last month, Chief Justice John Roberts said he was very leery of getting involved in this partisan gerrymander case because the court shouldn't be inserting itself into the middles of big national political debates. This is the same court that struck down a big section of the Voting Rights Act. This is the same court that struck down McCain-Feingold. So it's this complicated, depends on whose ox is gored problem that we're having here, which is, of course, the court sometimes intrudes into the national political scene. Sometimes it doesn't. It makes no sense to use the metric of when are they activist or not. The question is, when they strike down things that you don't like, we tend to say, good, that was the court doing the right thing. That's not the right way to analyze this. And certainly, I think when John Roberts says, in one breath, we can't get involved in partisan gerrymanders, it's too political. By the way, the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. It shows you that this is really, really, I think, a piece of theater much more than a sort of sound analytic principle.
Robert Barnes, back to you with the Washington Post. Theater as opposed to judicial deliberation. How's that distinction sound to you?
Well, Warren, I think that the court, it does contradict itself over and over, just as the Senate does when it talks about judges. And so you can say that that's politics. You can say that that is the way that they happen to analyze a case. But I think that we do see over and over that it's very hard to sort of thread these things apart. I think that what Dahlia said about the Chief Justice was a really interesting one, because this is not a guy who has been hesitant in the past when he sees big issues that he thinks the court should get involved in, as Dahlia said. And he seemed to strike a chord that was unfamiliar in saying, you know, we can't decide this one because it might get us too much in the middle of politics, and that the country won't be able to understand what our role is. I mean, it's the court's job to explain to the country its decisions.
So, Zoe Tillman, back to you with the BuzzFeed. We heard the president indicating he thought he could get nominated or get confirmed a very large number of judges. How's he doing so far? How many vacancies have been filled, and how many remain open and are likely to be filled, certainly during his presidency, should he serve the entire term?
So
far, we have 8 appeals court judges and 4 district court judges confirmed, in addition to Justice Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. As of now, there are 137 vacancies in the federal district and appeals courts. We know there are more than a dozen more vacancies that have already been announced. And to date, there are 46 district and appeals court nominees already waiting for action by the Senate. And there are more seats opening up every week, and we're getting a pretty steady stream of nominees from the White House every week or every couple of weeks. So as of now, with these vacancies and these judges confirmed today, Trump is poised less than a year into his presidency to fill about 19% of active federal judgeships. It's a large proportion of the federal bench. They're moving through the Senate at a pretty fast clip. Democrats have been, in most cases, allowing Trump nominees from their home states to move through committee, to have hearings, although there has been some discussion of this procedural mechanism that Dahlia referred to called the blue slip process, which gives Democrats a bit of leverage in committee. We're not exactly sure how much leverage they'll have going forward.
That's when when a senator can object to a nominee that comes for his or her own state.
That's right. And in the past, it's been used to stop nominees wholesale from having hearings. The current chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Grassley, hasn't said yet what he'll do if and when Democrats say they're going to use this blue slip process to block nominees from their states. We have a handful of nominees where Democrats have said they're going to try to use the process to block them, but Grassley hasn't indicated one way or the other. We know that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would like to see Grassley schedule these hearings regardless of whether a blue slip has been returned or not. We're still waiting on that. And then once these nominees have gotten to the Senate floor, they've moved to a vote pretty quickly, and there's been discussion among some Republicans of changing some of the timing rules so that they can get to a vote even faster than they have before. So, you know, if everything continues as it is now, they're going to keep getting judges confirmed on a regular basis. And, you know, with more seats opening up, more nominees coming in, the administration is making a lot of progress here in a way that they really haven't been able to on their legislative agenda. So this has been a real win for the Trump administration in their first year.
Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com, you've reported and told us on this program that at least one of the nominees called Justice Kennedy a prostitute. I believe another one has been rejected by a unanimous vote of the local ABA. I don't know if the American Bar Association, I don't know if that's the same justice or not. But do they appear to be moving forward and likely to get Senate confirmation?
Yeah, I mean, the judge who referred to Kennedy as a judicial prostitute was, in fact, confirmed.
Already confirmed.
Last week, the ABA returned a not qualified rating for a judge who had a hearing last week. And it was interesting. The hearing turned into a referendum on the ABA, who has done this kind of nonpartisan vetting for decades. The hearing turned into a, you know, oh, this guy on the committee donated to Hillary. Therefore, the whole ABA is somehow disqualified and partisan. I think, Warren, in a deep way, the conversation about the judicial branch has become so partisan that there's almost no way to talk about this that isn't completely corrosive and political.
Ilya Shapiro, back to you. What about that? Do we want people who have spoken out in the way that gentleman has? Is it appropriate to just denounce the whole ABA because they didn't like one particular appointee?
Well, the ABA is a left-wing interest group like many others, so I think it
the American Bar Association is a left-wing group.
It is. But I mean,
what left-wing principles does it serve? What do you mean by that?
It files brief regularly on I don't want to get sidetracked and talk, but the membership of the ABA is a small minority of lawyers across the country. It has a problem with if you ask people, the reason why the last two Republican presidents haven't asked it to serve as vetting nominees beforehand is because this is widely known. It is not the ABA of 40 years ago from when Lewis Powell was its president and became a member of the Supreme Court from it. But the larger issue is that what we have, this is kind of the denouement of a a dynamic where our parties have been completely ideologically made more coherent. There's a liberal party and a conservative party. You know, even 20 years ago, that there was much more mixing and more moderates. At the same time, the theories of constitutional and statutory interpretation completely now map onto liberals versus conservatives. And at the same time, there's this more focus, especially by Republicans, on jurisprudential theories and commitments that wasn't there before.
Let me go back to Robert Barnes of the Washington Post before we run out of time here. Are we seeing the last, or have we seen the last, of the American Bar Association being able to make recommendations and have them taken seriously?
Oh, I don't know. It comes and goes, you know, depending on the administration. I don't think so. I think that Ilya's right that Republicans do think that it is a left-wing organization and they don't really trust it. On the other hand, it found Gorsuch well-qualified, and that was trumpeted during his confirmation hearings. And so, you know, I think it, again, it's hard to sort of thin these things out because there is it has become so partisan that it's really hard to take at face value what either side says.
Okay. Neil Gorsuch, of course, the Supreme Court justice confirmed by the Senate because of the after the appointment by President Trump. It's great to have you all on our program. Robert Barnes with The Washington Post, Ilya Shapiro with the Cato Institute, Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com, Zoe Tillman at BuzzFeed, and our earlier guest, Jeffrey Toobin, New Yorker and CNN. Great to have you all. Many thanks. On today's Talking Point, a major shakeup in Saudi Arabia, a nation in trouble. Back in a moment with To the Point. Warren Ali here with today's Talking Point. Crown Prince bin Salman is in line to be the next king of Saudi Arabia, and he has tightened his grip on power with a weekend purge of 11 princes, 4 ministers, and tens of former officials. The royals are being held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh. Not a bad place to be. All of the officials, though, are being charged with corruption. Professor Toby Jones at Rutgers University is author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Professor, great to have you on our show.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me back.
Tell us, first of all, who is Crown Prince bin Salman?
Well, he's the favored son of the current king, who edged his way into power recently by replacing a former cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, as crown prince, and sits in line to take over the throne. Over the last 2 or 3 years, he's certainly been the most powerful actor, the most ambitious actor within the royal family. And the recent news developments over the weekend certainly underscore how ambitious he is and how he sees himself as needing to legitimize his own position in the kingdom.
What does corruption mean in this context?
Well, corruption, you know, the Saudis are masters at using these kinds of phrases, whether it be terrorism or reform or corruption, as a blanket frame for making sense of domestic challenges, domestic problems. In this sense, I believe that the major royals, what bin Salman and what others might consider to be rivals or potential critics of his position, are not really corrupt figures in any exceptional way. That is, they're not extraordinary in Saudi Arabia. Corruption is a convenient frame to vilify and to justify cracking down on them in the short term.
So you can call it corruption if you want, but it's business as usual?
It's business as usual. I mean, this is standard operating procedure. And let's remember that the kingdom is founded on an exercise of extracting wealth from the sale of oil, and that wealth consolidates in the hands of the royal family broadly. So those who sit atop the royal family power structure have the prerogative of distributing it as they see fit. So they're all more or less playing a game of moving money around that they capture on the global oil market to pad their pockets and to privilege themselves. One is no more, no less corrupt than the other in that framework.
One who's been arrested, I presume he's at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, is a billionaire businessman with a lot of interests here in the United States.
Waleed bin Talal, who's a major operator within Citibank, of course, has a history of contentious politics in and around New York City shortly following 9/11, but also sharing some acrimony with Donald Trump when Trump was on the campaign trail just a couple of years ago. Waleed bin Talal is a major figure, a very wealthy man inside Saudi Arabia. His arrest is surprising.
So what happens, as particularly to somebody who's being held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel? Are they likely to take him out of there and put him in a more or less comfortable place of detention? Is there some way that the court system will, make it easier for him?
No, there is no judicial frame. There's no judicial system that will adjudicate the fate of these royals. There will be some sort of, if I had to guess, there will be some sort of political compromise whereby those arrested royals and senior officials will yield publicly. They'll affirm the legitimacy of bin Salman, will officially step aside in any meaningful way from the power structure. They may be held under house arrest for some time. That's the fate of former Crown Prince Mohammed bin Naif. So it wouldn't be surprising to see some kind of public performance of fealty to bin Salman, which is probably what he's after in the first place.
So is this on his part a demonstration of strength or a demonstration of weakness?
Well, I think it's a demonstration of weakness. Let's consider bin Salman's record over the last 2 years or so. He's the architect of the Yemen war, which by all accounts is failing. And by the way, against the backdrop of all of this this palace intrigue and maneuvering, the Houthi rebels in Yemen fired a rocket on the capital city of Saudi Arabia on Saturday evening. So they're flexing their muscles. They have not gone anywhere. So the Yemen war is a failure. The siege on Qatar and the GCC crisis more broadly, which has also been Salman's idea, is also not going as well as they had hoped. Their domestic challenges, the economy is flagging, their worries about the long-term health of oil and the oil economy, his vision for economic reform, which he announced about 18 months ago, Saudi Arabia 2030, is also off to a poor start. And his promise to publicly share shares of Saudi Arabia, to open it up to a public offering, are also in deep question. So he's got a track record of failure, which means there's all kinds of domestic uncertainty and criticism of this very young royal family member.
What about the relationship with Iran?
Well, we need to keep both of these things in sight at the same time. Iran continues to be, according to Saudi rhetoric, the principal rival in the region for Saudi hegemony. The Saudis, along with the Israelis, will claim that the Iranians are the most dangerous actors in the neighborhood. The recent resignation of the Lebanese prime minister in Saudi Arabia itself, in which he cited in his resignation speech the threat that Iran poses to domestic Lebanese politics, follows what looks like an outcome in which Iran will retain the upper hand in the Syrian civil war. And the Saudis claim that they're beleaguered and embattled by this dangerous regional actor. And there are connections between perceptions of Saudi domestic uncertainty and anxiety with what they claim to be regional anxieties. And so bin Salman's moves domestically are almost certainly linked to his claims about vulnerability and uncertainty in the region.
You mentioned Lebanon. The prime minister of Lebanon, Mr. Hariri, resigned, and he was in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia at the time. What's the significance of that?
Well, it certainly shows that he, at least, on the Lebanese sort of chessboard, is beholden or subordinate to Saudi interests. It's too early to say. There is speculation that the Saudis may have forced his hand in an act to put pressure on Hezbollah and Iran inside Lebanon. I certainly have no insight as to whether or not that's the case or not. It's one plausible scenario. But the Lebanese political order, its political economy, are deeply influenced by Saudi interest. I think the thing to watch is whether or not tensions between Hezbollah and Israel flare in the coming weeks and months.
What about the clerics in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabists that they are? What has that meant in terms of international relations in the 9/11 hijackers and others? How much influence do they have with Crown Prince bin Salman?
Well, they don't have much influence. In fact, there have been two remarkable developments this fall over the last 4 to 6 weeks or so, which in other times might be more noteworthy, and we would certainly pay more attention to them. One is that bin Salman has eased restrictions on the guardianship system that keeps Saudi Arabian women in a subordinate position. He's also, of course, ordered that they will be allowed to drive legally very soon. The other move was to crack down and to rein in the authority of clerics that were considered to be extremists or dangerous from a religious perspective or from the perspective of political Islam, possible supporters of jihadism. So bin Salman is attempting to roll back the authority of those in the spiritual marketplace who might not agree with his prerogative.
The economy, you said, is in trouble. What does that mean for the global economy if Saudi Arabia is struggling?
Well, Saudi Arabia could certainly become unpredictable, although they have much less power over the oil market than they might have two generations ago. I don't think it means much for the global economy. And the reality is that there's plenty of oil. It's relatively modestly priced. The Saudis would be in a difficult spot if they shut off their own tap. That would raise the possibility of others swooping in and gobbling up market share, including American oil shale producers. Saudi Arabia is not in a position of strength when it comes to global oil like they were in the past.
And very quickly, a helicopter crashed yesterday. Several people were killed. One of them was a crown prince, one of the royal family, was on the helicopter. Do we know if there was any connection to that? I don't suppose it was hit by a rocket from Yemen.
Well, and there was a second royal family member who was killed in a shootout while attempting to be abducted by security forces, one would believe, in the context of this broader roundup. I can't say for certain what the helicopter crash means, but where there's smoke, there's fire in these scenarios.
Toby Jones, again, professor of history, Rutgers University, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. Just want to point out that the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh is not accepting any reservations for the rest of this month. It's owned by the Marriott chain. Toby Jones, great to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International. We'll be back.
Public Radio International.